This is David Hausman. I'm here with Jairo Acuna Alfaro on August 26, 2009. Mr. Acuna, have you agreed to this interview?
Yes, I have.
Thanks so much. So I'd like to start by just asking you a bit about your background and how you came to work at the UNDP and what you do here.
Well, I used to work with UNDP in my home country in Costa Rica from 1995 to 1999 in democratic governance issues. Then I moved to the World Bank in Washington, D.C. from 2001 to 2004 and worked on the governance and anti-corruption in the World Bank Institute. And then moved on to Oxford to do my PhD in political economy. And then after that, I moved to Vietnam since September 2007.
Great. And can you describe how you came to work on civil service reform in Vietnam?
As part of my work responsibilities on public administration reform, civil service reform is one of the key, one of the pillars of the public administration reform process in Vietnam. And this is one of the areas in which UNDP has been supporting the government in this area, and in particularly, David, my first introduction with civil service reform was in the initial drafting process of the recently approved civil service law, early in December 2007.
Great. Could you talk a little bit about the issues and challenges facing the civil service before the current reform process?
Well, this is a tricky question because there are too many issues, right? But if I may say, you know, if I, with no order of priority or importance, lack of clear rules in terms of recruitment, promotion, appointment and dismissal, dual appointment systems. You have for one side, on the one side, you know, the government, and on the other side, you have the party structure. You have very low salaries for civil servants, and then you have a distinction between public officials and civil servants. And indeed, you know, there is a it's even more than this. Distinction. There is a distinction between public officials, civil servants, and public service providers. So there are three categories in Vietnam, which is the Cán Bộ in Vietnamese means a public official, Con Chuc, which means civil servants, and Viên Chuc, which means, you know, the people that works in public services, like teachers, nurses, doctors, and so forth. So, you know, this is roughly speaking, you know, things that I can think of my mind, you know, the main issues in civil service in Vietnam.
Right. And can you say a little bit about the goals of the, just broadly, of the civil service reform program in Vietnam before we get into some more detail about the individual components?
Well, I think that there has been a honest attempt from the government, you know, to modernize, to include merit-based principles for recruitment and promotion, especially. And I think that, you know, also as part of the, you know, the natural evolution of the public administration reform process, the country now is moving towards, you know, more professional, more accountable, and more clear guidelines in terms of performance management of civil servants. But, you know, this is, you know, David, you know, very, very, very broadly speaking. You know, we need to take into account, you know, the starting point for this reform process, which is in Vietnam, is, you know, very, very low. Right? Coming out, you know, from years of of lack of clarity in terms of civil service. With no civil service, right? The predecessors of the civil service law is the ordinance on public officials and civil servants from 1998. So this is very recently, even you know the ordinance. The ordinance was subsequently amended in 2001 and 2003, right? But still, you know, it's only 10 years of experience dealing with civil service reform issues. And the law, you know, it has its weaknesses and its strengths, but it's an attempt in this direction of, you know, modernization of the public sector.
Right. Could you say a little bit about the motivation for the reforms? Do you think it was mostly a response to donor conditions, fiscal needs, aspirations to raise status internationally? Mm.
I think that there is a combination of those elements, David. The public administration reform master plan that has its origins in 2001, as I mentioned to you earlier in the introduction, one of the four pillars is on civil service reform, right? And the government since the early 2000s, you know, has been working on this reform process. And so I cannot say that it was already timetabled and that they will have a law on civil service in 2009, but you know, it's part of the reform process that has started since 2000. There were some pilots regarding performance management systems. There has been a governmental task force or commission to review salaries and to work on salary reform. Speaking beyond just, you know, salary increases, right? Salary reform. And the creation of the Ministry of Home Affairs also, you know, as the agency in charge of civil service issues is also one of the, you know, elements, you know, in this direction. So motivations are many, right? But you can say that this is part of the reform process of the entire public sector in Vietnam.
Okay.
And there's the other elements of, you know, corruption, you know, systemic corruption in the country. I think that, you know, this is seen as a key pillar. And the criticism regarding the low effectiveness and efficiency of the public sector. And so another motivation is precisely, you know, how do we deal with systemic corruption issues in the country? And how the country can increase it's you know, the quality of the services that it provides to the population. A lot of discussion also around the civil service law in terms of motivation was, what does it mean, the transition from a low-income country to a middle-income country, to Vietnam? And how can the public sector, and specifically, you know, the people who work in the public sector, you know, sustain and improve upon those new income levels?
Great, thanks. Could you describe the people you think were constituents for this reform, or was it mostly, did it mostly come from the government itself?
I think it came from the government itself. So, specifically from the Commission on Organizational Personnel and from the Ministry of Home Affairs. Yeah. I think that this is definitely a government-driven process.
Great. So now I'm going to go through and ask you about several specific kinds of civil service reforms. Let's start with professionalization and merit.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe the procedures and standards used in the system of recruitment in the civil service now, and how is this different from the previous way of doing it?
There are no procedures. There are no job descriptions. There are no clarity of functions and responsibilities in the vast majority of the public sector, and Yeah, it's still, you know, very, very precarious in that sense. Oh, you know, of course, you know, for the top position, yes, you know, for the ministers, vice ministers, director generals, you will have more or less, you know, defined criteria and job descriptions, but for the bulk of the public service, of the civil service sector, and especially in the rural areas, there is no clarity and no transparency in those aspects.
Is there an entrance exam that is standardized?
There is an entrance exam, but you know, it's heavily criticized and prone and vulnerable to corrupt practices. And
And is this changing in any way?
Well, with the new civil service law, it's hoped that it's going to change, you know, that the standards will increase, that there will be some work in terms of competency frameworks and recruitment practices, starting with job descriptions, right, for civil servants. But as expected, you know, this is a very slow process of reform. Right? The law that we are talking about was approved in November 2008, and it will be effective on 1st of January 2010, more than 1 year after, right? Which is very unusual. Usually laws in this country have a 6-month period after they have been approved by the National Assembly. Right? In this case, you know, it's more than 1 year for to give the government and the Ministry of Home Affairs, you know, time for preparation.
Right. What criteria do you think are used in practice in hiring and promotion?
Let me see, how do I say this? To be politically correct, I think that, you know, the first criteria is level of loyalty to the political system, right? And nepotism still prevails, and then, yes, political affiliation. And for... Yeah, when I say nepotism, you know, it's, you know, who you know within the public sector and what your connections are, and who is supporting you up in the higher levels, and so forth. Yeah.
Let me step back a moment before going further and ask you what you think have been the greatest successes of in civil service reform so far in, say, the last 10 years.
It's a difficult question, David, because there has been many pilots. I mean, Ho Chi Minh City, for example, has piloted performance management systems, right? But it has not moved beyond a pilot. It has not been mainstream or streamlined into the public sector. Let me see. Well, I don't know if you can say that, you know, to have a law is better than to have an ordinance, right? At least in the hierarchy of the normative legal documents, right? And that might be a success. The creation of a Ministry of Home Affairs, right, focused on civil service issues, right? you might say that this is, you know, success story, right? In itself, you know, that has been working on those issues. But yeah, it's it's a tough question to answer because, you know, it's difficult to see, you know, even, you know, islands of excellence, right? You will expect that, you know, or at least, you know, the country that I come from, you know, you see these ministries, you know, who, you know, in which, you know, civil service is very strong, you know, based on merit and recruitment principle, but it's not the entire civil service system. It's, you know, one specific sector. In this country, you would say that, you know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, for example, it will be interesting, you know, to see who is being recruited and how they are being recruited in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which might be one of the strongest and most professional ministries in Vietnam, with highly educated people working in the ministry.
Let me take you back a moment to merit recruitment procedures and ask you about how the new law envisions changing those and how those changes occurred as kind of a process.
Well, the new law is, for the first time, you know, it mentions the word merit as one of the principles for the civil service, right? Which is, you know, might be, you know, and you know, a step forward regarding the ordinance, that it specifically mentions, you know, the principle of merit in the civil service. And to my understanding, what the Ministry of Home Affairs has been doing is, you know, in working on a series of guidelines for the recruitment of people according to their according to the position, right? So, you know, I think that, you know, that there would be a new set of rules and regulations for the way in which public officials are recruited and promoted.
Can you say any more in detail about those new guidelines?
No, because I haven't seen them. Okay. I have not seen any of these documents beyond the law.
Okay. I've heard from others that one of the achievements of the new law is the separation of cadres from civil servants and public officials.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree that that's an achievement of the law, and what would you say about that?
I think that that's an achievement because it tries to create, you know, this separation between, you know, the higher levels of what in the Western societies would be labeled as political advisors, right? You know, the senior civil service appointments, and, you know, the core of the civil service, you know, that remains in place irrespective of changes in government. You need to take into account, David, that this is a country that, even though it's a one-party system, every 5 years there is a change in government, right? There is a change in the cabinet, there is a change in the National Assembly, there is a change in the party structure as well, every 5 years. So every 5 years, you know, there is a new set of ministers, there is a new set of vice ministers, and so forth. So, you know, the law makes this distinction, right? The problem is that, you know, the way that the distinction is being made in the law, and this is something that we are starting to see until recently, right? We didn't foresee this before. These two categories that I mentioned before, Cambo, right, in Vietnamese for public officials, and Conchuk for civil servants, right, were more like informal, hierarchical ways of referring among people, right? So if you had a position of a status and privilege, and you had some level of seniority, you would be referred to as a Cambo, right? Irrespective of the position that you were holding, right? So you could have a Cambo, somebody who is actually not a Cambo, but, you know, a Conchuk. But in the official way of referring, you know, among the people, they will refer to that person as a public official, right? As a proof of respect and of seniority. Right? But that was more informal. Now the law is formalizing that relationship. So you might have a big group of members of the civil service, right, who now are referred as Cambo, and from January 1, 2010, will have to be referred as Conchuk, right, because it's formalizing the relationship. So it might be downgrading those categories. So I don't know what the implications are, right, and this is something that we are working on, you know, try to identify, you know how this could be handle in practice. And the other element is, you know, that there is a third group of, how can I say, public employees that have not been included in the law, right? Which are, you know, as I said before, you know, the so-called Vienchuk, who are the civil servants working in the provision of public services, like teachers, nurses, doctors, and so forth, who are not included. And what we have been hearing from the government and from the Ministry of Home Affairs is that they are working on a separate law for public employees. Right. But also on this distinction between Cambo and Conchuk, also one of the things that, you know, that we have been hearing is that, you know, probably, you know, the government, well, in this next revision of the civil service law, let's say in 3-5 years, you never know. One option might be, you know, well, you know, to separate the Cambo from the Conchuk, separate, you know, the cadres, public officials, from the civil servants, and have two separate laws. So at the end of the day, you know, they will have, you know, three separate laws regulating, you know, three different groups of civil servants. So to make the answer short, yes, in the beginning, you know, it was seen as a positive development to have this separation. But apparently, you know, it's not that straightforward how you made that separation, and that might be conflicting with, you know, informal practices within that are pretty much based on the culture of the Vietnamese and the way that they refer to each other in the public sector.
So has there been resistance to the formalization of the separation between Cambo and Conchuk?
There has been discussion. I don't know if resistance, right? There has been discussions. And the Ministry of Home Affairs is working on also implementation decrees for these two categories of employees. But again, you know, David, we haven't seen those decrees yet from the government.
Okay, thanks. Let me go on to the next area, retrenchment and staff size. Have there been any attempts to decrease or increase staff size in the civil service here? And if so, what specific goals did they set and what form did they take?
I don't know.
Move on to the next one.
I mean, it's possible. There has been some attempts. You know, what I can tell you is that, intentionally or not, what has happened in the public sector, especially last year, was a very big brain drain from the public sector to the private sector, right? Especially in the finance sector and in the banking sector, which might have represented some sort of, you know, downsizing of this of the public sector. But I cannot say if you know there has been any policy from the government to on these issues.
Well, since you bring that up, do you know whether there have been the initiatives to counter that brain drain? And if so, what sort of initiatives?
Well, there was discussion last year on, you know, how do those positions would be filled up, right? Because the problem of the brain drain last year was that it was not in very technical levels, right? I said before, in the banking and the finance sector. How do these people was going to be replaced within the system? There was an attempt to bring forward people from the waiting list, you know, people who have passed the entry examinations and were on the waiting list to participate in the public sector. And also there were some attempts, you know, to publish some recruitment, you know, open competitive recruitment processes. With job descriptions and so forth. I would suspect, you know, that most of the positions were filled up. But you know, again, you know, the question is, you know, what was the specific criteria that was selected, you know, for those new appointments, and you know, for the promotion of people. I don't know. I cannot. Answer, you know, with much more level of detail.
Okay. Let me go on to ask you a few questions about pay policy. The cost of civil servant wages is often a major problem and a strong impetus for civil service reform. Could you talk about any changes that have been made to pay policies here? Have there been attempts to decompress pay, to increase wages, decrease the total civil service wage bill?
Mm-hmm. As I said before, David, you know, I think that, you know, there has been a government task force to review salary reform structures. The Ministry of Labor has been working on increases. Small increases on the minimum salary levels, and I think that in the past 2 years there has been a significant increase in minimum salaries, but still, you know, salaries, you know, people keep referring to them as, you know, as very low, as not sufficient to satisfy living conditions, and then there has been some attempts to revise the coefficient system in the civil service, in the salary structure.
Could you describe the coefficient system?
Well, the coefficient system, you know, based, you know, according to, you know, the number of years that the employee has, and, you know, the position that he holds, you know, he will have kind of a premium to his monthly salary, and is based on a coefficient, you know, according, you know, to different criteria. I can give you, you know, later, you know, the different, you know, coefficient categories. But, you know, basically what it tries to do is, you know, to have a distinction between, you know, seniority, right, and level of responsibilities according to the job. And also there has been some policies to, how do you say, to promote relocation to mountainous and difficult areas in the rural sector. There are some specific policies on that. But if you ask me, David, you know, I think that, you know, yes, you know, salaries are low, but if you count only the salary, right, there are all these, you know, other non-monetary sources of income, you know, to say that, you know, that, that civil servants receive, like housing, for example, right? And I think that, you know, this is part of that. I don't know if that's been included in the salary reform process, but, you know, this is, this has to be also, you know, taken into account, right, other benefits to the, in addition to the monetary income, you know, that these people receive. And then my other comment on that, on the salary issue, you know, we know that corruption is systemic, that is rampant, that is everywhere, that is at all levels. But we also know that for certain positions have a price tag, right? That if you want to have a certain position, you have to pay, right? And last year, there was a very exposed case in the media in which a government official paid around $10,000 for a position that will officially give him $1,200 a year, for example. Right. So how do you account for that?
What position was that, and what official?
I don't have, you know, the specific details. I can send them to you. It was in Kamau province, but there has been tons of studies on this issue of pay. But that was, you know, the discussion. How is it possible for such a low paying position, you pay such large amount of money? So what are the, you know, the expectations, you know, that, you know, the kick backs that government officials receive, you know, for those specific positions? So I think that it's not a problem of lack of resources from the government, right? It's a problem of how the incentive system is organized in this country. And we know that public officials, you know, get, you know, all these envelopes, you know, to attend different activities, different meetings, you know, to participate in different task forces and so forth, that you can see them as, you know, bonuses to their salaries, right? But all this is very informal, right? Well, it's informal in the accounting system. It's formal in the public sector, you know, to some extent, right? So why don't we, or why doesn't, you know, the government of Vietnam tries to work on what I call the officialization, making official all these informal sources of income, all these practices of, you know, of giving and taking, you know, envelopes to participate in other activities in addition to what, you know, the, you know, the civil servant is, you know, is supposed to be, you know, to be working. And some people will say that this is an extreme case of meritocracy, right? Because this is, you know, the most talented, you know, the most, you know, the, you know, the, you know, the most intelligent, the most proactive people, you know, who get a request, you know, to, you know, to work on these other issues in addition to his or her position, and it's through working on these other addition issues that, you know, that he or she can get all these envelopes. So why don't we try, you know, to work, you know, on the making official, you know, these informal sources of income. Because at the end of the day, it's money that's coming from the public sector, right? It's not that these people are working for the private sector, right? It's money from the public sector that is circulating around, right? And the different departments, you know, they have budgets, you know, for envelopes, right?
So something like the housing allowances that you mentioned, are those informal as well?
They are formal according to the position, but, you know, again, you know, how big is your house, right? Or if you are retired, you might be given some piece of land, for example, right? But how are these distributions, you know, allocated? Somebody in the National Assembly, just one of the examples that I didn't know that he was given, is that, you know, the average salary of the member of the National Assembly, which I know is not included in the civil service law, but is around $500 a month, right? But if you add, you know, all these other allowances, you know, like car, like, houses and so forth, it tops up to 1,000, right? So his proposal was, why don't you increase the salary of these people, right? $1,500 a month, right? And you forget all about all these other, you know, extra allowances, right? And you know, that person, you know, can concentrate fully on the task that he or she is supposed to undertake as a civil servant.
Can you say a little bit more about the salary task force that's been formed?
It's a mystery. I don't know who the members are. I know it's led by the Ministry of Finance. But I haven't seen any report from the Salary Task Force, right? And I think that no report is expected until, I will need to revise, but maybe next year.
And you were just saying that there's a need for the monetization of various benefits. Has any of that taken place already?
Not that I have seen. Not that I have seen.
How has the new system of allowing service delivery and administrative agencies financial autonomy affected salaries? Has that, do you know whether that has had any major effects?
I don't know. Yeah, sorry, I don't know. Yeah, I'd rather say I don't know than, you know, to give you a misleading answer.
Let me ask you a few questions about the political context of the reforms. What political factors have affected the reforms, would you say?
What political?
Political factors have affected the reforms.
Thank you. Let's see. I think that at the moment, none, right? Because I think it's Article 9 of the Civil Service Law still, you know, very strong and very, very, very prominently, you know, the role of the party in the civil service. Article 8. I guess in a very, very non-political factors, you know, have been affected. You know, still, you know, the government keeps the dual appointment system, right? Still, there is this government commission of organization, no, the Central Committee Commission of Organization and Personnel within the party. That is the one, you know, who decides who goes where and when and how and why, right? And so the answer to your question, what are the political factors that have been affected with the reform? The answer would be maybe none.
Okay.
Right. The incentives are still there, and it will be very difficult because of the one-party nature of the political system.
During civil service reform, many countries make significant organization or structural changes in government. Could you talk about the changes that have been made in the way the civil service is structured?
Well, you know, again, you know, the creation of the Ministry of Home Affairs is one of those. There has been an attempt to reduce the number of ministries, right, but not the number of staff, and to work towards what the Vietnamese call it macro management ministries, right? And also there has been a lot of discussion about socialization of public services, which in other countries you would use the word privatization, right? And I guess that this is related to your earlier question. But you know how it has affected the structure of the government, it remains to be seen. One of the things that we have been discussing about is, why don't we try to set up within MOHA a unit that documents successful cases of public service, public administrative service, public services, and public administrative service provision, that recognize those achievements, that rewards excellence within the public sector, and that disseminates, you know, best practices of public service in the country.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the attempts to reduce the number of ministries? Which ministries were eliminated?
The Ministry of Fisheries, for example, was merged into the Ministry of Agriculture. So now we have, you know, I think that this is perhaps, you know, the largest ministry in Vietnam, the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development, and it makes sense considering that 70% of the population lives in the rural areas. And there was a Ministry of Investment and a Ministry of Trade, and now you have one ministry, Ministry of Trade and Investment. And there has been also some discussions to merge the Ministry of Planning with the Ministry of Finance. But still, you know, you have two separate ministries so far, right? I can send you by email, you know, this table that we are compiling of, you know, what have been, you know, the significant changes in numbers, right? We need to go into the details of, you know, which are the ministries and so forth. But historically, from 1975, the tendency has been that, you know, first there is an expansion of the number of ministries, and then there is a contraction, and then another expansion. There has been like two waves in that regard, and now, you know, the tendency has been, you know, towards the you know, the compression in terms of the number.
How would you describe the motivation for the merging of the ministries, and how did it actually work out?
Attempts to rationalize services. Attempts to respond to citizens' criticism and honest attempts from the government to find ways, you know, to provide better public services. And also, you know, it's all this, you know, integration of Vietnam within within the world economy as well, you know. I think that, you know, many of the WTO requirements for example, might be, you know, playing an important part. And also, you know, they nowadays Vietnam is much more exposed to other countries in terms of how the government is organized and how the government is structured. And so it looks at, you know, examples from other countries in terms of governmental organizational structure, and might be some attempts, you know, to emulate success stories and bring, you know, those cases to Vietnam.
And can you give me examples of particular cases of rationalization or reaction to public criticism?
Well, the Ministry of Fisheries, for example, and the Ministry of you know, the merging of the Ministry of Fisheries with the Ministry of Agriculture. There was a you know, big criticism in terms of, you know, to what extent, you know, the government was having uncoordinated responses to the largest segment of the population of this country, which is in the rural areas, right? And so one of the responses of the government, okay, you know, let's put together these two ministries, right? And let's see how we can rationalize, streamline, and have a more coherent and easier mechanism for rural workers to interact with the government agencies, right? In this regard, for example, right? The other is in the public administration system, and the classical example is the one-stop shops, which are, you know, these offices that have been set up all over the country as a way to facilitate and expedite the granting of licenses and certificates to citizens.
Since you bring it up, let me ask, I was actually about to ask you about one-stop shops. Could you describe how they first came about?
Well, they first came about, my understanding is that it was a pilot in Ho Chi Minh City in the mid-1990s, if I'm not mistaken. And what Ho Chi Minh City tried to do was, you know, to have, you know, what in other countries is called, you know, one single window to process and tramit, you know, licenses, mostly for businesses, right? And then it was expanded, you know, to include services that, you know, citizens, you know, can have. The model was seen as a success in Ho Chi Minh City, which is an urban province, right? And then it was, you know, replicated in Da Nang, in Hanoi, and later on it was, you know, established as a national policy. And now, you know, every one of the 63 provinces have one-stop shops, you know, as a way to, you know, to try to expedite the provision of public administrative services to citizens.
And which administrative services do the one-stop shops cover?
Birth certificates, land permits, construction permits. I believe that driving licenses. Yeah, mostly. There was an attempt to have one-stop shops for public services, right? Like, you know, healthcare centers and so forth. But, you know, the rural nature and the rural conditions of most of this country, you know, make it, you know, very difficult. And so now, you know, the one-stop shop focused mostly on what is called public administrative procedure, right? If you need a permit, if you need a license, then, you know, That's what these one-stop shops are aimed to do.
Do you know whether they've tended to reduce the time necessary to get these permits? And if so, do you know any examples of?
I cannot remember now out of my mind, but you know, I can send you some information on that.
You mentioned macro management as a concept. Could you explain what that is?
Well, a macro management, you know, what the attempts in the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development, for example, is, you know, to try to work more in the policy, you know, the setting policies and less on, you know, implementing and delivering specific public services. It means more outsourcing. It means more decentralization at the local level, and it means what Vietnam calls socialization of public services. Right?
Could you say a little bit more about that?
What the ministry is, what the MART, the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development, is looking for is to find different ways to provide services to the farmers, right, and to the rural sector, by way of not implementing directly, but by way of, you know, having more strict control mechanisms, more deregulation, and, you know, allowing the participation of the private sector in the provision of specific services for the rural sector. Right. So it's more, you know, to think about a ministry that set up the guidelines that is more that has more regulatory functions than a ministry that, you know, delivers, implements on a daily basis. Right? That's my understanding of the macro management system. And I guess that will have some impact and some influence in terms of the civil service. Right? How, you know, the functions that they have to perform will be more regulatory than implementation.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Let me now just ask you generally about other civil service reform or public administration reform programs in which the UNDP is directly involved that haven't come up.
No, that's basically it. You know, we have been supporting, you know, what I mentioned to you about the one-stop shops in Ho Chi Minh City, in UNDP, we were supporting them. An effort that was later on picked up by the Swedish Development Corporation on the one-stop shops, on the replication. We are also supporting the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development in this transformation. And we also have a project with the Ho Chi Minh City on public administration reform. And we have a project with the Ministry of Home Affairs, supporting them on the implementation of the master plan of public administration reform.
Can you describe how your program with the Ministry of Home Affairs got started and how your cooperation?
It started since the origin, since the early 2000s, with the drafting and establishment of the PAR master plan from 2001 to 2010. We have been supporting the ministry in that effort, and through the development of different task forces to draft this program of reform. And then we, you know, the UNDP has been supporting in the implementation. And in 2005, there was a review that UNDP also strongly supported, an internal review of the process. And now what we are doing is, you know, supporting them with the evaluation from the past 10 years of implementation, but also helping them with the implementation of specific, with some specific reform processes that have no relationship with civil service, but like, you know, establishing a monitoring and evaluation system to measure public administration performance, for instance, to pilot the abolishment of people's councils in some rural areas, and to propose different options and models of public service delivery issues.
Okay, thanks. Let me end by just asking you a couple of general questions. If you had a chance to do some of these reforms over, so for example, the drafting of the law that's going to take effect soon, are there things you would do differently this time around?
Yes.
There are many things. Which ones?
Well, if I had to draft again the civil service law, I will do it in a more participative manner, for example. And I will do much more research and much more analysis of the structure of the civil service system in the country. I will do lots of surveys to try to measure performance, measure perceptions, measure degree of competition within the public sector, within the civil service, for example. Right. The bottom line is, you know, rely more on hard data and less on anecdotal evidence.
When you say you'd make the process more precipitatory, how did the process actually work? And what were you
well,
doing?
There was a task force that was set up with around 12 members, and most of them were from the Ministry of Home Affairs. Right. So one of the things, you know that there were, you know, one member from the National Assembly, a couple of members from the Office of Government that I can remember. So, you know, this is one of the first things, that I will do, to diversify the composition of the drafting team. And then go out and consult more with the stakeholders involved. It's not enough, you know, to have meetings only with the drafting team, among members of the drafting team. But, you know, go out and, you know, collect opinions in a much more scientific and systematic way. I mean, there was some level of consultation, of course, but it was not as focused and widespread as, you know, one would have expected to be.
Do you think there are any aspects of the civil service reform here that reflect local traditions or cultural practices that one might not understand without understanding
those
practices?
Many, many things. Like, you know, not having, you know, clear job descriptions, right? And I think that's, you know, inherent in the Vietnamese culture. Hierarchy levels, again, you know, this is a very hierarchical society. The way that the people refer to each other also, you know, has some influence in the way that, you know, civil service is structured and organized. And then, you know, the one-party nature of the political system again, right? Which is, you know, very different than, you know, than many other countries.
When you say that not having clear job descriptions is inherent in the culture, what aspect of the culture do you think?
I think that it's it relates, you know, to the working habits. That, you know, my impression, and this is my own personal impression, that the working habits is much more reactive and much less propositive. So, you know, the civil servants, you know, are just, you know, sitting there waiting to receive instructions, and there is no culture of open public and deliberation and argumentation. You don't disagree in public with your colleagues and least with your supervisors, right? For example. And that, you know, that's a way in which, you know, the system, you know, having this unclarity in terms of the rules, in terms of the functions, that allows, you know, this room for discretion, right? And it's good for me as an employee, and it's good for you as my supervisor, right? Because, you know, as a supervisor, I can ask you, you know, whatever, you know, I feel that, you know, you should be doing, right? And as an employee, I can do all these other things that, because there are no specific rules on what should I be doing or not, right? So I can get access to all these, you know, informal sources of income that we were talking earlier. As long as I distribute.
Well, thanks so much for answering those questions. I just have one or two concluding questions that are more general, kind of drawing on your experience here. If you had a chance to write a handbook for people who manage civil service reform in challenging environments, what kinds of topics would you think were most important?
A handbook for
people, people like you, trying to help implement civil service reforms in difficult environments.
I would include the importance of job descriptions. The handbook will provide details on how do you do competency frameworks. On how do you evaluate performance? Different ways, you know, to evaluate performance. It will well, the first thing that it would include is a description and explanation of merit as a principle, and what it means and how it works, and recruitment practices, right? Examples of, you know, best or best practices or good practices. There are no best practices. Good practices in terms of recruitment, and yeah, and maybe the handbook will include something about different civil service systems in different countries. And, you know, what are the key characteristics of those different systems.
All right, well, thanks so much.
Hope it was useful.